Welcome, everyone. If you're at the Critical Look of Open ID panel, then you're in the right room. Otherwise, you should exit and find the right room. And it's pretty tough in this place, too. My name is Jason Levitt, and I used to be with Yahoo, and now I'm not. And we've got a distinguished panel of Open ID experts here for you. To my left is Artur Bergman, Director of Engineering for Wikia. Then David Recordon, Open Platform Tech Lead for SixApart. To his left is Simon Willison, who you can't see anymore. Because he likes that you know, sinister mood there, with the lighting coming from the keyboard. Can we get that back?
Wow.
That's pretty good, actually.
This guy.
We're trying for some. Okay, so Simon Willison, who's once again in the dark.
Just light.
This is good.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Simon Willison, a freelance Open ID evangelist. And then to his left is Andy Smith, who's an army of coding monkeys from Google, all by himself, one guy. He's an army. And then at the very end of the desk here is George Fletcher, who is AOL's OpenID architect. So we're going to start off. Simon's going to give us a nice 10-minute presentation that's going to introduce everybody to OpenID. If you don't already know what it is, and we get a show of hands real quick. How many people have an OpenID?
That should be everyone if you've got a Yahoo or AOL account.
How many people have used an OpenID in the last 5 days?
Maybe wow. Simon's presentation should be a little shorter.
Yeah. I've already trimmed it down a bit. I want to
see it. How many people voted for Barack Obama? Okay. How many people voted for McCain? How many people? Okay, just trying to get the mood of the audience here. How many people voted for Hillary Clinton? Okay. How many people didn't vote? How many people voted for somebody else besides those people I mentioned? Ah.
Yay. Okay.
Okay.
So I think we've established the mood for Simon, who's from England and couldn't vote for any of those people. So Simon's going to start off with a nice presentation, and then I'm going to do a really short little bit. And then we're going to have some directed discussion about some of OpenID's various issues of the moment, and then we're going to finish off with a Q&A, so everybody can get a word in. So Simon, you want to start things off?
Sure. So I normally give this talk in half an hour and talk very, very quickly. So today I'm giving it in 10 minutes, and I'll try and talk slowly, and we'll see how that goes. So OpenID, everyone here's heard of it, so here's the classic slide. OpenID attempts to solve the username and password problem, the problem that we've got dozens and dozens of accounts dotted around all over the internet. We have to pick a username for every single one, and sometimes you can't get the username you want. We're supposed to pick different passwords for every account so that if one of those passwords get compromised, we don't lose everything. But of course we don't, but then we can't remember which password we used anyway. So it's a total nightmare, and it's unsustainable. And the web needs single sign-on. It needs a mechanism where you can sign in once and then be signed into many different sites, and has done for a very long time. And of course, people have tried this in the past. Microsoft, quite a few years ago now, Microsoft announced Microsoft Passport, which would solve everyone's problems by having everyone create an account with Microsoft and give them all of their information. And that would solve the problem for the whole internet. That didn't go over really that well. SixApart did Typekey, which does single sign-on for blog commenting. Facebook have an API for this. There are a lot of attempts at this. It's interesting to note that Microsoft Passport, universally reviled, didn't quite go away. They changed the name, and they subtly changed the logo to see if people wouldn't notice. So now it's Windows Live ID. But I think that logo kind of gives it away. But anyway, these things don't take off because single sign-on with a single controlling authority betrays the principles of the web. The web is great because it's decentralized. Anyone can put up a web page. Anyone can put up a website. But if you've got one authority controlling all of the accounts, then that's one organization or company that can arbitrarily decide who's allowed to play and who isn't. And that just doesn't work and has been rejected by the web community. So OpenID is a new take on this. It's a decentralized mechanism for achieving single sign-on. So it's kind of like email. Any company can set themselves up as an OpenID provider, and there's interoperability between them. So you can use OpenID, you can sign in, you can have one account to sign in everywhere, but you don't have everyone having to pick the same provider. So there's not one organization or company that holds all of the keys. And the way it works is an OpenID is a URL, which is great because URLs are globally unique identifiers, thanks to the lovely old domain name system, which we'll probably talk about a bit later on. And so my principal OpenID is simonwillison.net. It's a domain name that I own. It's also got my blog there. And all the OpenID protocol lets you do, effectively, is prove that you own a specific URL. And because you're the only person that can prove ownership of that URL, it means OpenID can be used as an authentication credential. Instead of passwords where it's a secret that only you know, an OpenID is a URL that only you can prove ownership of. The way that works, you go to a website, you go to, say, the South by Southwest site. That site says, well, who are you? You say, I'm simonwillison.net. Site goes, prove it. Magic happens. And this panel is all about the magic. But we won't be doing any tricks, I don't think. And the site's convinced and says, okay, you're in. This works much better as an explanation if you see it running. I once tried to live demo OpenID on a conference Wi-Fi network, and I'm never, ever doing that again. So I've got some nice little videos showing how this all works. But to log in with OpenID, I'm going to pull up 37signals Basecamp, which has been an OpenID consumer, a site that you can sign into with OpenID for quite a while now. And so they've got their login page, and they've got a little login with OpenID link at the bottom. I'm going to type in my OpenID, swillison.livejournal.com in this case, a live journal with the originators of OpenID. I click sign in, and Basecamp looks at my OpenID, and it figures out who the OpenID provider is that looks after that and finds out it's LiveJournal. So then it sends me over to LiveJournal, because Basecamp doesn't know who I am, but LiveJournal hopefully does. So I'm on LiveJournal now. LiveJournal has no idea who I am. I'm not logged in, and tells me to log in. So now I type in my LiveJournal username and password, and this is the single sign-on. This is ideally the only username and password I'll ever need to use. I click login, and now LiveJournal asks me a question. It says, Basecamp wants to know who you are. Is this okay? And I can say, yes, I want them to know who I am. Yes, I always want them to know who I am, so I always trust this site. Or I can say no. And so I'll click yes, always. And I get redirected back to Basecamp with a bit of magic in the URL that essentially cryptographically proves that I really am the owner of that account. And Basecamp's convinced, and it lets me sign in. Now, that was a lot worse than regular sign-in, because we've entered a username and password, and we've clicked links, and we've bounced between sites, and we've clicked buttons. But the nice thing about OpenID is that now that I've gone through that initial process, at this point, I'm logged into LiveJournal. And LiveJournal also knows that I always trust Basecamp. So if I sign out of Basecamp again, and then sign in, I can type in my LiveJournal OpenID, and the browser can auto-complete this for you as well. And then I click the button, and if you watch the status bar very carefully, you'll see it sends me to LiveJournal, and then sends me straight back. LiveJournal knows who I am. LiveJournal knows that I trust Basecamp. So the sign-in happens with a couple of invisible redirects. And essentially, I've logged into that site after just entering my username. So that's one part of what OpenID can do for you. It can help you out with usernames and passwords. But it can also help with account creation. Every time you sign up for a new service, you're expected to provide a sort of minimal amount of information to that service. And OpenID has a feature called Simple Registration that can do all of that for you. So I'm going to sign up for an account on a site called welovelocal.com, which is a London restaurant review service, kind of like Yelp. And so they have a sign-up form. They ask for usernames and emails and passwords. But as an alternative to that, you can sign up by entering an OpenID. Here I'm using simonwillison.myopenid.com, which is another provider. So I click the sign-up button. This time I'm sent over to myopenid.com, and again, they want me to sign in there. Ideally, you'd sign in sort of once at the beginning of the day, and then you'd be signed into your OpenID provider for the rest of the day. And now I'm asked that question again, but in addition to do you want We Love Local to know who you are, it also says We Love Local wants to know your full name, your email address, and your postal code. do you want to pass those details over? And I can say no, or I can say yes, that's fine. If I say that's fine, then I get sent back to We Love Local, and I'm on the sign-up form, or a condensed version of the sign-up form, but it's filled in all of those fields for me. So it's click the button once, and I've signed in. I've got an account on that site. That was the story with OpenID up until sort of the end of last year, and it kind of worked. But a lot of people were freaked out by the idea of having to enter a URL, because a URL isn't a username, even though with OpenID it is. So there's a great new feature in OpenID 2. Which has just been implemented by Yahoo. Yahoo became an OpenID provider a month ago. And OpenID 2 lets you, rather than entering your OpenID, you can enter the address of your provider. So instead of saying, I'm simonwillison.yahoo.com, you can just say, I'm yahoo.com, and it'll figure it out along the way. Now, that's not an improvement, but it does mean that on its own doesn't help things. But it means that sites can give you a button. Instead of saying, type in your OpenID and click go, it can give you a nice big purple sign in with OpenID, sign in with your Yahoo OpenID button. And so I'll show you that running on a site called Jite. The Jite sign in form lets you sign in with an OpenID, but it also lets you sign in using your Yahoo or Flickr account. And there's just a button down there. So I'm going to click on that button, which is the equivalent of typing yahoo.com in the box. And now I've been sent over to Yahoo's OpenID provider, which lets me select one of my OpenIDs that Yahoo provides. I can say, yeah, I'll go with that one. I click let me in, and I'm sent back to Jite and signed in with that OpenID. So this is fantastic for regular users because it's just button clicking. There's no typing at all. So hopefully, so that really, really helps with the usability side of things. I wanted to wrap up this 10-minute lightning introduction to OpenID with an analogy that I find really useful. And that's to compare OpenID with email, which everyone understands. So with email, it's up to you to pick which email provider you want to trust with your mail. You can say, well, I want to use Gmail, I want to use Hotmail, but you'll still be able to communicate with users of other email providers. And OpenID is exactly the same thing. You pick the provider you trust, but you can interoperate with anyone else supporting that standard. Also, email allows you to run your, if you're technically adept, you can run your own email service. You can look after your own mail, which you can do with OpenID as well. That's not really an option for the masses. But an interesting thing about email is that email is very frequently used for single sign-on. Every time you go to a site and you click on that I forgot my password link, and the site emails you sort of a one-time token to get you back in, that's single sign-on. It's just single sign-on with a really lousy user experience. And one way of thinking about OpenID is that it's a formalization of that sort of email, open up your mail program, click on the link thing, but one that doesn't suck. And finally, another thing, interesting thing about email is that someone's email address can say something about them. If you get an email from tbray@sun.com, if you see the email address tbray@sun.com, you know that that person works for Sun Microsystems. And Sun actually set up an OpenID provider last year, which does the same thing with OpenID. So if you ever see an OpenID that starts with openid.sun.com, you know that that OpenID belongs to someone who works for Sun Microsystems. Facebook, of course, did this with university email addresses when they launched. And it's easy to see a whole bunch of really interesting applications that can be built up around that ability to use OpenID to verify someone's place of employment or some other attribute about them. That's all I've got for the 10-minute introduction. I think I'm going to hand over to Jason to talk about what Yahoo have been doing with OpenID.
Arthur has a quick comment on this.
So the email analogy, I think it's also important to remember that OpenID in this case is actually more secure because email passes through X amount of providers that you do not control, and it doesn't use SSL. So not only is this a better user experience, it is actually more secure.
Okay, can we switch it over to my notebook real quick? Let's see.
We two or three.
This is the fun button pushing game. Maybe it's one.
Maybe it's six.
Three.
Maybe it's none of those.
Maybe your computer doesn't like it.
You have to do detect speech.
What's the
detect display?
Keep it up. Three. Should we just talk?
Yeah. Should we just start talking? Do the tech screen thing.
What?
So while they're working that out, just a question. It seems to me that your comment about OpenID being more secure is only works if the actual transfer of the OpenID protocols are over SSL, which isn't always required. There's a whole boatload of shoulds in the spec.
That is true, and I guess that's if, what kind of OpenID provider you choose to trust. I'm in favor of us actually defining an additional spec or recommendation guideline of best practices, and that best practices would involve requiring SSL in the same way that a lot of e-commerce sites use SSL and you trust them and you don't really trust the ones that don't.
Well, and I think some of that is sort of that question of like, what is the primary role that email providers have and OpenID providers have? Like you have email providers and the idea is that they're going to move email around. And most of the time you're authenticating just with a password. There isn't really an option with your email provider to say, oh, I want to do something more secure. With OpenID, the OpenID providers are more focusing on how can I be a really great OpenID provider. You have people going and integrating with like authentication over Instant Messenger, SMS notifications, playing around with things that don't even take passwords, and making sure to go and offer things like SSL to try to make the OpenIDs that they issue more secure. Where email has never really been focused on providing identity. It's just fallen into that path.
I would agree. I mean, I don't like it that a lot of the web email providers don't let me use SSL to get to my email. I'd much prefer that path to be secure as well. So I mean, the point about best practices is very good and something I think we need to drive OpenID providers towards.
That's actually another interesting part of that analogy is that people often complain with OpenID that it's putting all of your eggs in one basket. If someone compromises their OpenID, they can take over many different accounts. But actually, everyone in this room has a single point of failure. If you've got an email address that you use to sign up for many different sites, if someone can access your email, they can use password recovery to steal every account that you've got. So OpenID it doesn't make things any worse than the situation at the moment in that regard. Yeah. I think I may have just jumped ahead of the panel on that one.
Oh, well.
I guess my video output seems to be broken. Oh. Maybe my dongle's broken.
Do you want to try this dongle?
Yeah. So, do people disagree that OpenID makes it worse than the current status quo? No, I wanted like if anybody agrees, thinks that it makes it worse. Yeah. Sure, ask a question. How do you educate the normal user about OpenID? So I think efforts like what Yahoo's done will help with that in terms of, I think they've spent a lot of time looking at usability for their provider. I mean, like Simon's screenshot of the Yahoo provider, it sort of called out things like security, called out privacy, allowed the user sort of to choose more of the things that was going on. And they were really the first ones to try to do that, take advantage of a feature in OpenID 2 to make it simpler for people. So they just say, oh, I'm at Yahoo, versus having to think about what their OpenID URL is.
I mean, email has achieved mainstream usage despite the barrier to entry for email, at least a few years ago, was incredibly high. You had to configure POP3 access and all of these different things. And so I think what happens with this stuff is early adopters and technologists get the hang of it and smooth out all of the bumps. And then at the point where the benefits are so obvious that everyone else wants to get in, people will be able to get over that barrier. Plus, early adopters help make it easier. And yeah, like David says, the fact that companies like Yahoo, Yahoo's whole business is to do with mainstream users, they're very good at explaining this kind of stuff in a way that mainstream users can understand.
Yeah, and this might be the wrong crowd, but I was over at the Hula Hut on Lake Austin a few days ago, having my perfect South by Southwest experience. And we were arguing about this, a few of us, in terms of will people ever understand the concept of like they have URLs and URLs represent them. The argument that I made at that point of like being in a bar floating on the lake with like jet skis going by surrounded by like
college kids and all that is, like, I bet that if we walked around the bar asking them what their MySpace URL is, the majority would tell it to you.
They don't know what a URL is, but they understand the concept of a thing that is them on the web.
There's also discussion going on around mapping an email address to an OpenID provider, which I think also would help people understand better, because then all they would have to do is put in their email address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the question was, with OpenID 2.0, are there more mechanisms for anonymity built in compared to OpenID 1?
I think the methods for anonymity are, they're basically built into the service provider. In case of Yahoo, for example, they'll be able to generate a random string so that you're not actually sure who the person is. As people get better at being service providers, they'll be providing more random strings such that you can actually have a different URL for every website you log into.
So the question is if there's any sort of central record keeping with OpenID. The answer is no, which makes it really hard when we want to talk about adoption and like give any sort of statistics around OpenID. Like the best that we can do is go and create like pretty graphs from a single OpenID provider and be like, here, take a look at the trends in adoption versus actual numbers. Because no, I mean, OpenID is completely decentralized. There is no one that you go and say like, here, I want to implement OpenID. Can I, may I? Like, none of that exists. It's just like, you go download open source code. You can read the spec if you want to. You can write your own implementation. Yeah.
So the question is, when you get redirected to another site, is there any way you can trust that site not to be a phishing site? And that depends very much on what the OpenID provider has done. Like, if they have frame-busting code, if they use SSL, and like a lot of best practices, then you can trust them as much as any serious provider on the net, which is not really that much.
This is a really interesting one, because the problem is you go to an OpenID provider, they redirect you, you go to some random site and they redirect you to your OpenID provider. But of course they might send you to an evil imitation of your OpenID provider. And it turns out this isn't a new problem. This is something that PayPal has had to deal with since it launched. You go to a site, you're meant to click the little PayPal button. You click it, and it'll either take you to PayPal and you log in and pay money, or it'll take you to fake PayPal and you log in and you get all of your money stolen. So it's nothing new. I think PayPal, how do PayPal deal with that?
They don't. I mean, yeah. Think about it. Like, for years, you've had this experience online, and George will argue with me in a second, that's fine, that you go to this random website, maybe it has like a blinking background and something, and you're like, ooh, I want to buy that camera. Because like it has the best price, because Frugal told you like that was $10 cheaper. And you see this button of like, I can pay with PayPal. You just click the button.
Never look at where you actually end up.
How many people here actually react and go away when they see this SSL certificate is not kosher?
I think a fair more
than usual, but.
We're not normal.
It's still a low number.
But the thing about OpenID is that if you have one OpenID that you're using as your identifier for, if you're using to sign into many sites, then there's much more of an incentive for you to build a stronger relationship with that OpenID provider. And so there are lots of anti-phishing technologies that require some kind of investment in browser plugins or in sort of cryptographic tokens, which you just couldn't do with 100 different sites. But you might be willing to set those things up with one site. So as David mentioned earlier, there are OpenID providers that log you in by sending you text messages. Mm-hmm. In fact, OpenID providers are now competing on the basis of their phishing protection mechanisms, which is a really important trend.
So this is important to realize in the sense that OpenID is an enabling technology and enables a v- vast different of attempts to solve this problem. As SMS, you do an out-of-band authentication, and that's a pretty good current solution to phishing until people realize how easy it is to fake SMS. So, and eventually all of our machines are going to be owned, and then we're lost anyway. I've spent far too much time with security geeks. There is a provider in Estonia, which is really interesting. Estonia has a national security card that is an e-security card that actually even lets them vote. And it's used for all interaction with the government. Now, private sites can implement this to actually authenticate against it. However, most sites aren't, and especially not outside of Estonia. So this guy set up open.id.ee, which allows you to authenticate to the OpenID provider using this e-security card, and then use that OpenID to log in anywhere else, yeah. Which enables a pretty good, strong security line there, and allowing that kind of innovation to reach to people who really would never, ever implement it on their own site.
Well, and that's one of the things that's really interesting to me, is seeing people who are trying to compete and innovate around how someone authenticates from their computer to a service online. And it's really, I think OpenID has changed that game, because someone creating a new technology there doesn't have to now go and pitch all these different sites across the web that they should go and support the technology they're creating. That company can go and create an OpenID provider, and all of a sudden they can take advantage of the tens of thousands of sites which already support OpenID, and really focus on what they're good at and about improving authentication. From what Arthur was saying about that presentation, if you go look on SlideShare, there's an OpenID presentation from Web 2.0 Expo Berlin about 6 months ago, where Martin, who did that implementation, actually spends about 20 minutes talking about it if you want more information about what he did.
So we've been talking about basically how the OpenID provider can protect the user by using some level of second factor or strong authentication, you know, keys, other mechanisms. The Hadoop guys have the image thing. Right, all anti-phishing mechanisms. The other aspect is browser plugins have been being used to basically not follow the redirect. So the browser plugin, you configure it with your OpenID or with your OpenID provider, and it always takes you right there, and it basically breaks the redirect. And then when you're authenticated, you go back to the site and you fill in your URL, and then it will let it flow through. And if it sends you to a bogus place, you're not going to be authenticated.
So the question is if the trademark or name OpenID implies trust, and if we will lose that trust on a incident. This is why I think the best security practices is a good idea. I mean, anyone can do SSL, but the browser really complains if you don't do some things, because it's an expected way of doing it. And if we can define a best practice on how to deal with these problems, then we can say, you know, you can say that this follows the OpenID best practices, security document, blah, 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 and hopefully gain another bit of trust. The other thing I think is that there will be an ecosystem, or I hope there will be an ecosystem of people that actually judge the reputation of OpenID provider. There already is an email, right? You can go and get feeds of which email servers to trust. And if I ran a financial institution and I decided to look into OpenID, perhaps I would only trust a few OpenIDs that I actually think have a good sense of login, or that I can actually guarantee that there is one person behind this ID, which the Estonian example can.
Didn't AOL do that? Did AOL have certain properties you can sign into with OpenID? And I believe that they whitelist a certain set of providers for it.
Yeah, this actually gets to a different issue in regards to basically business risk around OpenID and sort of the scope of what that OpenID is good for. You look at Google's implementation, at least so far, and you can use an OpenID to leave a blog comment. And I think it's the same at LiveJournal as well. So our whitelisting ended up being basically just an easy way to sort of keep a handle on what was happening. Pretty much the website to request to get on the whitelist is, there's an email address on the website. And to date, I don't know that we've turned anyone away.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was more about sort of, you know, coming out over a year ago with our OpenID support.
I want to cut you off right there. Do you want to?
Oh, I was just going to say it was more about sort of managing that business risk.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I want to take a brief interlude here. We finally got the Mac switched around here, so I thought I'd do a quick five slides, just very brief, about OpenID at Yahoo. Yahoo became an OpenID provider at the end of January, in case anybody wasn't paying attention. So I'm just going to, this is real quick. A lot of this you already know, a few things you probably don't. Yahoo is an OpenID provider. That means anybody with a Yahoo ID can go and create multiple OpenID identifiers. Yahoo is not a relying party. That means that you can't use OpenID to log into any Yahoo property. Like if you go to Yahoo Finance or Yahoo Mail, you cannot use OpenID to log in. However, other, you know, third-party sites can use, as Simon demonstrated, can use Yahoo OpenIDs to log in. So Yahoo only supports OpenID 2.0 and will never support OpenID 1. And if you look around on the internet, a lot of things that just say OpenID, especially if you're a developer, are not OpenID 2.0. They're OpenID 1.x, 1.whatever. Simon showed that Yahoo supports what they call directed ID, a directed identity. That means that you can just use Flickr.com. You can type in Flickr.com or Yahoo.com, and it will take you to the login page so that you can go through the OpenID flow and authenticate. And if you want to get those little buttons for your site, if you're a developer, you can. That's interesting. You can go to that URL, which I can't click on. So if you want to find some sites that actually have implemented OpenID 2.0, the whole flow, you can go to gallery.yahoo.com/OpenID, and we've got like 10 of them, 12 of them or so. You can check out, and there are a few of them right there. So if you're a developer or a quasi web developer, web designer, whatever, and you want instant gratification, you want to create a site that can authenticate with using any OpenID that supports OpenID 2.0, there aren't a whole lot of alternatives at the moment. And these are the ones that I found by making a not an exhaustive search, but so if you wanted to add it to your WordPress blog, or if you wanted to create a Plone or Drupal installation that supports OpenID 2.0, you can check those out. And finally, if you're interested in more information, go to developer.yahoo.com/OpenID, and you know all the technical goods are there for you. So I want to continue on with our sort of directed conversation right now. I know we're doing kind of a Q&A, but I'd like to, I think we're going to hold off the questions a little bit for a minute. I want to get to some bigger questions. One of them is about...
let's continue with questions.
You want to do Q&A? Yeah, okay, I've been overruled. I've been overruled. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So go ahead.
You had the next hand. For largest relying parties, how do you define largest, I guess?
They said they would a year and a half ago.
Wikipedia. So Wikipedia does not take OpenIDs, and Wikipedia has said that they will not take OpenIDs until they've solved the single sign-on problem internally, because Wikipedia currently has unique user databases for each Wikimedia Foundation property. My view on that being completely external despite working from IKEA, is that why not use OpenID to solve that problem? Why not like log into German Wikipedia using your English Wikipedia identity? But they want to solve it, and there's been, if you read Wikitech, there's been a long discussion on who gets what username when there's a collision. The guy with the most edits, the guy who's been there long enough, and so on. But that's, they don't. I think Blogger would be the biggest one.
Yeah, Blogger, AOL has some.
Well, I mean, I think some of the most important ones actually are Basecamp.
Yeah.
So 37 Signals added OpenID to Basecamp and their other properties, partly to solve their own single sign-on problem. And an interesting thing that happened after that is that Blinksale, who make an invoicing application, which is a nice complement to the 37 Signals suite, also added OpenID support, which is kind of interesting because now there's this little collection of tools you can use to manage a small business using OpenIDs. And I think I fully expect that to start happening in other little niche areas as well. Once one site in a niche area picks up OpenID, it makes sense for the other sites in the same niche to also adopt it. So yeah. I think that's my favorite example is the Basecamp and Blinksale for sites. Mm-hmm. Those are the sites that I regularly use OpenID to sign into.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of support in open source software for OpenID. So that was something where the community spent a lot of time sort of the past year and a half was going and getting support in things like Drupal and Joomla, plugins for WordPress and MediaWiki, support in things like Movable Type and all these different community packages was sort of some of the idea and like track of like if you can start getting developers using OpenID more and more frequently, like then they'll start building into their own tools as well. And I think that's where a lot of the 37 Signals stuff came from was working to get it into Rails and then 37 Signals going and putting it into their own products.
There's a good example of that in that Reebok launched a vast campaign on Go Run Easy.
GoRunEasy.com. It was plastered all over San Francisco.
And so they had OpenID support. None of us knew who these people were or why they did it, or you know, they never talked
Reebok
to us.
Might not have known.
Yeah, but the thing is, Reebok might not have known because the developer who did it eventually commented and said, well, you know, I had this library, I just put it there.
Yeah. You've asked a bunch of questions so far. Let's try it.
Sure.
Google actually did Relying Party. The question was, why is Yahoo not a Relying Party, and how can we expect other companies to become Relying Parties if the large ones aren't? Google actually is. They did Relying Party first on Blogger.
Jason, do you have an insider insight there?
First, I wanted to point out that people should actually go walk up to the microphone if they want to ask a question. That'll make things really easy, and plus you'll get recorded too. And everybody will hear it. So the Relying Party part, the reason that I cannot speak to why Yahoo is not the Relying Party at this point, but I can say that it'd be a much bigger engineering task and a scarier one, or at least a scarier engineering task, to open up everything to OpenID 2.0 at the moment. And I think that's partially because OpenID is still kind of a nascent technology.
I would just say that I think a lot of times, especially companies that are maybe larger and grown up over time, tend to sort of have this mentality that once you get through the front door of authentication, you have full access to everything, right? And if in this process, we talked a little bit about reputation, we talked a little bit about trust, if the resources that you're giving away cost the company a significant amount of money, right? There's concern over letting anybody with any OpenID show up, right? I mean, someone did the OpenID provider in India. You didn't need a password, just give it any arbitrary name off the domain, and it fully supports the spec. There's nothing that says it can't implement the paid extension and do all that stuff, right? So then as a relying party, you got to go and make sure you blacklist that one or do something.
I've got a comment. This comes up every single time a large company becomes an OpenID provider. Hundreds of people on their blogs say, this is rubbish, why aren't they a consumer? It's yet another big provider and we need more consumers. And it's true that we need more consumers, but I honestly don't see this as such a big problem because Yahoo have, what, 150 million logins. They don't need OpenID to encourage more people to sign up. The organizations that benefit from OpenID right now are the small sites, the startups. If you launch a site and it goes on TechCrunch, 10,000 people visit your homepage, and then most of them leave because they don't want to create another account. So there's a massive incentive for you when you're trying to attract new users to a new service to use something like OpenID to ease that user transition. My expectation is that one of these small sites will become a big site, and then mainstream, once a large number of users expect to be able to use OpenID, user demand will start pushing it onto the larger identity sites.
So that's fine. I would say that I would recommend most people that have smaller sites don't bother being an identity provider, because that's actually a security hassle. If something happens,
you have to suddenly care about phishing.
So don't be a provider, just be a consumer. That's where your real value is, you know, letting more users use your site.
Right. And it's sort of that same idea of the people who are focusing on being OpenID providers, they're focusing on how they can be the best provider, how they can good things with authentication, with phishing. If you're going and building, if you're a startup and you're investing in how can I go and make my feature awesome, with OpenID, you don't have to worry about, okay, how do I do account management? You can assume that just about every single person that comes to your website, especially linked from somewhere like TechCrunch, already has an OpenID.
So they have a Yahoo account at least.
Exactly. It can be one or two clicks for them to start using your application versus having to think about, how long of a sign-up form do I want to fill out?
This kind of segues a little bit into that single point of failure problem that we were talking about earlier, where if OpenID becomes very pervasive and everybody has, say, if you have one OpenID that you use for 50 different sites, if someone finds out that OpenID and password, then they have access to all 50 sites. Whereas in the current way things are, or before OpenID, you had 50 different logins for 50 different sites.
Well, you didn't. But
yeah.
Well, you have 50 different user IDs, probably.
No, you don't.
And 50 different passwords.
Okay, how many people here have more than 5 passwords? Yeah, so half of you, and this is a fairly technical crowd, I assume. When I'm in a non-technical area and ask how many people have more than 2, it's usually 25% that say yes.
My uncle, who's an ER doctor, has one password for his bank and one for everything else.
Are they written on post-it notes under his keyboard?
No, but he does keep the little RSA fob that the hospital forces him to have right next to his keyboard.
Of course.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the key thing there really is just, use something more than a password. Lots of options.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm just trying to understand something basic about OpenID that maybe I'm misunderstanding. I know this might sound absurd, but if I trust Microsoft, my Live ID is a sort of OpenID. So it seems like the pitch for OpenID may be less some new technical solution and more asking me to reconsider and offer me more sources of trust. Is it more about the trust and that sort of thing and less about the monolithic technical?
In a way, it's a political solution. One of the many problems with Passport is that a lot of companies are not going to outsource their user account database to Microsoft because they're in a competitive situation with them.
Well, and it's not just Microsoft. It's people also having the idea that any one company or any one organization controlling the majority of identity online is a bad thing.
Won't you get that way if you get to the point where it's Google and Yahoo maybe are the majority OpenID providers and most people use those? Don't you end up with that kind of
result? Two's better than one.
You still have a choice, right? It's absolute lock-in. It's absolute monopoly. Yeah. Now, there might be a natural monopoly situation here, which I doubt, and there will be one or two or three providers in the end, but that's still not a technical mandated monopoly.
Right.
So there's options.
I think that's one of the largest differences from Passport is not necessarily the technical side of it, like you said, but more of you had to go ask Microsoft permission to implement Passport. You probably had to sign a deal with them, maybe get some money exchanged hands. And it just wasn't something that a small startup, at that point, it wasn't going to be something that it was really useful for them to go and invest resources in.
No, I'm sorry, can I just correct you?
Sure.
It does today. It didn't 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's I believe Yahoo had BBAuth and Google has GAuth or something similar, and Microsoft has Live. So the large providers have in some sense already allow this or enable this, but again, with the fact that there were three different APIs, three different standards, OpenID, in the sense of a technical solution, it makes it easier, but it's also very much a political solution.
Yeah, I was just wondering what you guys saw as the solution to the single point of failure problem. And on a sort of related note, what have you given thought to the potential of tying OpenIDs to maybe real-world identities so that, A, if I lose my OpenID, it's somehow tied to me and not just a string I type into a computer, B, so that I know that's different OpenIDs actually correspond to different people, and C, I mean, obviously for a lot of applications this isn't appropriate, but so that the idea of real-world reputation can be tied to an OpenID.
Right.
So to address the first point about the there's the single point of failure, which can sometimes be seen as what happens when my OpenID provider goes down, and now I can't log into any of my sites. So something that I recommend if you're going to implement OpenID on your own site is keep that I forgot my password mechanism, but you rename it. Instead of I forgot my password, it's I can't sign into my account. And it does exactly the same thing. It sends you an email, the email has a link, you click the link and you get in. So if there's a hiccup, if LiveJournal's data center is down, you can still sign into some other site, even though your LiveJournal isn't.
So Rebook did this in that when you signed up with your OpenID, they emailed you, they got your email address and they emailed you a password that if something happened, you could use.
So you've got backup.
Well, and there are a few different answers there. I think that's definitely one side of it from implementing OpenID. If you're using OpenID, there's the option to, instead of use the OpenID directly from LiveJournal or directly from AOL or Yahoo or Blogger or any of those places, to use a domain that you control. So like I use davidrecordin.com as my OpenID, and I delegate to a provider. But instead of just delegating to one provider, I say use this provider, but if it's down, then fall back to using this provider.
This is a feature of OpenID too, which is really handy.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, but I guess I was also more focused on the identity theft aspect.
So, right. So again, Estonia is a good example of there, right? You pretty much know that anyone coming from open.id.ee has a government-issued ID card that resembles one person, even if they can create random string open IDs to hide their real identity. And so that's really a question for the identity provider. Like your bank could become an identity provider, and if you lose your open ID or something, you go to them and you have a trust relationship with them. In Europe, a lot of the governments have it and so on.
Yeah. Most of the sites that I've seen so far that implement OpenID, when you first register at the site, if you already have a regular username and password at the site and they implement OpenID, they'll let you attach the OpenID to your existing username and password. So even if you lost your username, your OpenID, OpenID and password, you still be able to use your old username and password. And in addition, most sites that I've seen where you register as a new user that have OpenID will have you pick a username and password, just like in the old days,
they'll email you a password that they've created.
Sometimes, not often.
A lot of them do that I've seen, and then so you still have that, and that gets us into the sort of the usability stuff, I think. Yeah.
Another interesting model is allowing users to associate more than one OpenID with your account. So if LiveJournal's down, they've told you that they're also this person on Yahoo, and so they can still sign in.
And I think you're seeing that more with some social services where, one of the things Simon's talked about is there are a few different types of OpenIDs or OpenID providers. There's the type of the, I am an OpenID provider, I'm going to go do all these different things. But then also the type of just, I want to allow you to prove that you own this account on my service. And it's a much simpler one. But you're starting to see more from like the portable social network side that your people, services are asking people like, what's your Twitter username? What's your blog URL? What's your Delicious? What's your Dig? And so that's sort of, even if they're not intending to, building a list of multiple OpenIDs that a user could log in with. But also pimping the panel this afternoon, 5 p.m. panel on portable social networks. So,
I don't think that's actually addressing his question, which was about identity theft. So for example, if you have a situation where, let's say, LiveJournal recycled usernames, you would then be in the situation where once you've deleted your LiveJournal account, a year later, somebody can go and start logging into the same things that you once had because they got your same name. I don't believe that's actually the case for LiveJournal, but it's a very easy case to see. And I do think it's a large problem that just having redundant services isn't going to solve.
Yeah, so that is a way, something that OpenID 2.0 starts to look to address. And I know it's like that was one of the large things that Yahoo really collaborated on to make sure that didn't happen. But it's also a similar argument to be made with email today, where if 5 years down the road, your email address is recycled, somebody still could go write a script to go around to all the different websites that have forgot your password links and fill in the email address they just got and see how many fish they catch.
So again, we're not making things any worse. But it would be nice to make things.
Yeah. You mentioned simple registration, and it seems that Attribute Exchange is relatively new in OpenID, and so I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about the direction that's going, mm-hmm. especially with respect to the kind of multiple identity management through one provider that you alluded to with Yahoo as well.
So simple registration has been around for like a year and a half, maybe 2 years at this point. And the idea was simple registration by its name, really simple. So it takes 9 fields. So the people that wrote it went around and studied what are the common fields on new account creation, took the top 9, and just made it so that you can be like, an email address is required, a first name is optional, this or that. And that's actually really well supported because it's been around for a while and it's really simple. Attribute Exchange is a new specification that's part of OpenID, the OpenID 2.0 suite, if you want to call it that, collection. And it, instead of saying, here are 9 fields, it's abstract. So it allows people to go and create many different types of fields, many different types of attributes.
It's extensible.
Right, exactly. And it's definitely something that it's starting to be adopted now, but doesn't have anywhere near the adoption that simple registration does.
Hi. Actually, those 9 fields, I was wondering, is one of those birth dates? Because one issue for a lot of sites I've worked on, and I don't know, not for everybody, but probably for a few sites, is the whole issue of COPPA compliance. And a great extension, for instance, would be if there were certain providers who you could know were trusted to only hand you IDs of people who were over 13 and over 18, but that's not mine.
Different market.
So I was wondering if you had some comment on that.
That's
the field is part of the 9.
Well,
but it's no use to you at all because people could lie.
Yeah. Right, but no, it's actually been done in like a technology demo basically, and like of interop, because Attribute Exchange spec, since it is extensible, someone's defined a birthday field there, but it's a birthday field with a signature. So what it actually does is takes advantage of SAML assertions at the same time. So that you can both say, here's the birthday, and owe this company, which is makes its business by verifying personal information, vouches for this person is actually this age on this date.
Right, but that's one of the key aspects of the Attribute Exchange, is that you can exchange those third-party signed attributes. Mm-hmm. The simple reg, basically, birth date's there, but you know.
Yeah,
but so simple reg is effectively only good for pre-filling forms.
Yes.
A lot of people make the mistake of assuming Simple Reg will be there and saying, well, I required the email address provided by Simple Reg, so I'll throw a horrible exception if I don't get it back. So but really, the only safe way to do it is to pre-fill the sign-in form with whatever comes back. And if nothing comes back, just to ask them for that.
So I would say that you want to pay a good lawyer a lot of money if you're prepared to trust any external source you do not have a legal contract with for their COPPA information. Because I would say it's extremely unclear if that actually protects you against COPPA violation.
Though I think Symantec is starting to build some of this, or at least has been playing with it in their desktop part of Norton. They have an identity selector which supports OpenID, and they're also looking into things like verified attributes of how could they move that around, being more of a trusted brand there.
Okay, we got to move on to the next question.
Sure. First question, real quick, revocation. What is the management process if I've got a site that I've allowed and then I don't want to allow them to do that anymore? Mm-hmm. And the second thing is more theoretical. Let's say Yahoo disappears, gets absorbed in Time Warner, or gets absorbed in Microsoft. Certainly the same thing as email. If my email provider goes away, I need to go and redo this whole process all over again. But is there any kind of management process that's been thought through on this?
So revocation is really up to the provider that you use. So most providers, just as there was that screen that Simon showed of, yes, I want to allow this data exchange, will both log it so that you can actually see when it's being accessed, as well as then give you a way to revoke that. So not actually, you can't go to a site and say, oh, you have to give me my bits back. But being able to say, next time that the site asks, don't just give it to them, ask me first.
Yeah.
On the Yahoo site, you know, you can, if you go into your account that you used associated with your Yahoo ID, you can see the open IDs that you created, and you can delete them if you want, recreate them.
Okay. What about the question about if the provider you use as your key OpenID for all these sites goes away? Is there any transition?
So can you bulk rename your OpenID on the 30 sites
you're
using?
That's my question.
No.
But yeah, but if you do things like delegation, so use your own domain, then if Yahoo goes away, you could delegate to someone else.
Yeah.
And part of it is also just that, well, if they still want to be a trusted brand, they're not going to go do something like that.
Yeah. So try to pick an OpenID provider that isn't fly by night. Is useful.
Hey. So I'm Peter Nixie from ClickPass, and we've been doing a ton of work around OpenID and trying to make it easy to use. So I'm interested in asking you guys, and obviously in this audience as well, asking the audience what the blockers are for OpenID, because there's a ton of interest around it. I mean, the room's packed in here this evening or this morning. There's a ton of interest around it, and it's clearly almost at its tipping point, but it's not quite going over. And it seems that the protocol itself is now superb and covers pretty much everything technically that we could hope it's going to cover. But there are still things that are stopping people in this room and people elsewhere from having already installed it on their website. So is it now a stage? What do you feel the main blocker is? Is it the security aspect of OpenID? Is it the usability aspect? Is it the technical challenge of implementing OpenID? What do you think is going to take it over the edge?
Should I think it's everyone.
Should
here?
We go down the
well,
line?
Do you want to do that? Do you want to raise hands between security, usability, and technology for people in the audience that are thinking about integral anything?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Who's being stopped by security? Okay. Usability and technology.
Really? Technology. So it can be a little bit fiddly to implement. It's the first time you do it. It's a couple of days, I think, unless the toolkit you're using just does it out of the box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that we did one in San Francisco a few months ago was an OpenID dev camp. So sort of off the bar camp style, but more focused around code and implementations. And want to start seeing more of those happen. So if that's something that you're interested in organizing an event wherever you live around OpenID, feel free to, I'll say shoot me an email and I'm happy to help. But I think that goes to just about anybody else as well, that they'd be willing to help do that.
Right. I do think that since the most hands were raised on usability, that there are things that could be done to help, normal users sort of get over the hump. And that is to do things like introduce them proactively to the interaction between maybe an account they already have and a site that they're on that could leverage OpenID, right? Now, some of this takes code running on their device, right? So OpenID as a protocol works fine in a just normal browser with no extra plugins, but VeriSign, Seatbelt, Skipper, those kinds of things could do more to basically tell a user, you have an ID, it's an OpenID, and you can use OpenID on this site. Do you want to do that?
Yeah.
And I think that would go a long ways to help the usability side. And
Peter, isn't this what you're working on? Usability?
Yes. Yeah.
You want to say something about that?
This wasn't meaning to be a plug. It was
30-second product pitch.
Yes. So we're launching tomorrow with a product that basically takes OpenID and makes it as easy as we possibly can for users. We've tried to wrap up a lot of the complexity around it. We've tried to make the flow as simple as possible. And just that, I mean, what we found when we've been talking to a lot of people and getting them to install OpenID, and we've watched a lot of users trying to go through the flow, and we've now got it pretty simple. I mean, if you're familiar with OpenID as it stands, it's very easy using our stuff. But I think even so, I mean, there's still more work that we're going to have to do, and there's just a lot of user education that's going to happen. I mean, it's a full paradigm shift. People, all these questions that come up: what happens if my OpenID goes away? What happens if somebody breaks into my account? I mean, the truth is,
we need to get to the next question because we don't have much time left. So, do you have a URL or something?
Yeah, it's clickpass.com.
So I'm kind of skeptical to the entire user education and the entire make it easier to use. I think it's just user education. Look at Vista. How many damn boxes do you have to click? And within 10 minutes, people click all the boxes, and there's no real usability to it. And I personally, I'm really depressed about it, but that's, you know, user education is just going to solve it or never solve it.
So we need more boxes for people to click.
Yes. Apparently.
Ticker. Hi, I'm wondering if there, if anybody knows if there's a technical reason why something like Plaxo doesn't, it uses OpenID for the website, but when you get to the desktop application, you can't use that. So if you haven't signed up for Plaxo with a regular account as opposed to an OpenID.
One word answer, OAuth. The OAuth spec, OAuth.net, was originally invented to solve that problem. It turned out it could be used to solve other problems as well, but it's essentially a sort of formalization of the Flickr authorization API, where you go to Flickr, Flickr says this site wants to see your private photos, yes or no. Look at OAuth.net, it solves that problem, and it integrates with OpenID really effectively.
Yeah, and it's the idea of really small and loosely connected parts, so combining OpenID and OAuth to solve that sort of problem.
Yeah.
So is that an issue that Plaxo should be looking at to implement?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Hi, my name is Jacob. I actually had a quick question about the data security and storage of personal information. As providers, OpenID providers hold a lot of personal information, and a lot of it is accessible through things like the simple registration protocol, things like that. But during Simon's demo, it looked like it was an all or nothing access to the information. Is there anything that's being done that where providers can actually help users protect what information they give away to other sites?
Yeah, that's completely up to the implementation of the provider. So I don't, like a lot of providers do it field by field, and I think you can do that with my OpenID as well.
Yeah. That's called attribute exchange, right? And
that
simple registration. With my OpenID, actually lets you do that with personas, so you can create multiple personas with multiple different, which I don't think is quite the right way to do it, but definitely field by field is an option for providers to take, and quite a lot of them have done.
This is a solution that a protocol cannot solve, right?
Yeah, it's a... Also, practices.
Also, there's, for example, with Skipper, one of the things that they do that helps with this sort of thing is they actually will let you make fake email addresses. Well, they make arbitrary spam protected email addresses that you can send, things like this. So that's the stuff that the provider can use to allow you to give information that isn't necessarily associated with you.
And it's all value added on top of the protocol.
Thank you.
But
to be the last question, we're all out of time.
Will OpenID help fight comment spam?
Yes.
No.
Well, do we want to hear the case for no first?
Sure, no. And like as was pointed out earlier, someone could set up an OpenID that just, you know, allows
a spammer can create a million OpenIDs.
But the question will help fight versus will completely solve. So yes, because I mean I work for a blogging company, and like one of the things that we're moving towards doing is if a blogger has said, this is my account on Twitter. Like, if one of their friends comes and comments using their Twitter OpenID, assuming Twitter supports OpenID as they said that they would, then we can go and bypass spam moderation. We can actually know, these two people know this each other. They're friends.
The ultimate way to beat comment spam is whitelisting. You say, these are the people who can post comments on my blog without going through my spam filter. And before OpenID, that was ridiculous because no one's going to create an account on everyone's blog. Now that we have OpenID, you can say, here are 100 OpenIDs that I trust to post comments on my blog, and you can share that list with other people as well. So I think distributed whitelisting, using Twitter friends, using distributed friends lists, is a way that we can solve comment spam built on top of OpenID.
That goes back to having, you know, reputation providers of OpenID providers that, you know, aggregate this information. I agree, it will help solve spam. Help fight it barely until the economic advantage against shifts to
blacklisting is a waste of time.
But thank you. We'll stick around, I think.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.